All right, let's turn back to 1 Samuel and want to make reference to theologian Calvin and Hobbes for just a moment. I came across one of the strips or the episodes for Mother's Day several years ago that was in the paper, in which he wakes up his mother and he says, "Hey, Mom, wake up. I made you a Mother's Day card." And his mother, in the next panel, she's sitting up, rubbing the sleepies out of her eyes, and starts to read it aloud. And this is the card to end all cards, okay? "I was going to buy a card with hearts of pink and red, but when I thought I'd rather spend the money instead. It's awfully hard to buy things when one's allowance is so small, so I guess you're plenty lucky I got you anything at all. So happy Mother's Day. There, I've said it. Now I'm done. So how about getting out of bed and fixing breakfast for your son?" So if your card was above that, be very thankful. I think that all of us can say that the God of all grace gives us whatever we need to face whatever he puts before us. And stories such as the story of Hannah and Samuel remind us what we should do when we have a great need and to whom we should go. Samuel is going to chronicle the life of David and do a masterful job of it in thrilling chapters. We think sometimes that everybody knows these stories, don't we? We had the opportunity to, a young man was walking through our neighborhood, and we got a chance to talk to him about the Lord and about the church, and I gave him a bridge tract and asked his name, and it was a variation spelling of Elijah. And I said, "So you know of Elijah in the Bible?" And he looked at me like I was from another planet, like Pastor Perry said this morning. And I said, "Oh, you've got to let me spend some time with you and get you caught up on God's power through a prophet by the name of Elijah." But Samuel doesn't start with David or Saul or with himself. He starts with the account of Hannah. And our text goes back before she was a mother and before she was joyful and before she was a joyful mother. For these years, she must have found it very difficult to come to the temple, to come with sacrifice, to come with joyful praise. It was, her life was weighing down heavily on her. And she prays, and God gloriously answers her prayer, gives her a son who becomes a prophet, who is very critical at the hour of Israel's need. And as we study these two chapters, I don't want us to just appreciate Hannah as a woman or as a mother, but I want us to see her as a pattern of how God met her need and what she did with her need. And I think it becomes very obvious in these, if you'll look with me in chapter 1, in my study, I came up right from the start, we are given four factors by Samuel that contribute to her hurting heart. Can you find them as we go down through here? What are some of the, you can speak out on this is okay. This is part of the interaction part. What are some of the things that weighed her down and distressed her? Diane. All right, she had a one who provoked her for her inability to bear children. What else?
Well, she was one of two in the first place.
She was one of two wives to the same man. God's design for marriage had always been from the beginning, one man and one woman, and any variation of that was a recipe for disaster, and having multiple wives or polygamy or homosexuality, all those things were perversions. What's the two other obvious ones? She was unable to have children. That's right. One was one of the wives. Peninnah was blessed with the ability to produce children, and one was unable to produce children. And it became very obvious in this text that there's nothing that she nor her husband can do to make this problem go away. By the way, she's one of six ladies in the Old Testament who are described as barren. Let's see if we can come up with some of the others. Rachel, I said Old Testament. That might be a little tricky. One of them's kind of Old Testament. Rachel, who bears Joseph. Who else? Sarah, who bears Isaac. Elizabeth, who bears John the Baptist. That's that Old Testament, New Testament one. Okay. One that we don't know the name of. All right. Manoah's wife, Samson's mother. And Rebecca. Okay. Our culture, in that ancient culture, to not have children was looked upon as being passed over or not receiving a blessing. Our culture may not look at children, the ability to have children, the choice to have children as a sign of God's blessing. But they do look at other things. Oh, if you're doing well, or if God's blessing you, then you have, or you don't have, you don't have problems, you do have this. Some of the ways that the world would say, you and I are deprived, we would say, no, actually, I'm very blessed. Thank you very much. She was provoked for her inability to bear children. You wonder what were some of the ways that Peninnah pressed her advantage. If she did not kind of come alongside and say, kind of like Job's counselors, okay? You know, there must be sin in your life. It's kind of an interesting sub-theme here of food in these two chapters. But she stops, not only is she unable to have children, she's unable to eat. She stops eating because of the deep distress on her life. And then there's one other. What is the... All right. She's got a priest who thinks she's drunk, and she's got a she's married to a man who doesn't understand and is certain that he does. We'll come back to that in just a moment. Clearly, he favors one of his wives over the other. Again, a recipe for disaster. One has children, the other has what? Food. He gave her extra portions, okay? I would guess that these two ladies probably spent as much time as they could not bumping into each other. But when you were headed to make sacrifice, you were headed to a festival and you had to travel together, you know, something along the lines of, I see your double portion of food. Boy, you want to trade one of those for a couple kids? Or you know, some. When he asks this loaded question, in verse 8, am I not more to you than 10 sons? I think there's a probably a wise silence to a foolish question there. How would you answer such a question? Do you ever feel like no one quite understands you? Let's move it away from a barrenness situation. You just feel like, I have a problem that I can't quite communicate, that seems obvious to me is from the Lord, and I'm provoked for this problem. How do we react when no one seems to understand our situation? All of this, though, is moving her in a direction, I think. She goes from being able to say, like some of the women would, well, I'll just talk to my husband about it. My husband will understand. He's compassionate. He will tell me what I need to hear. She doesn't get that. Nor can she exactly go to the priest. She's got a choice of either wicked, weak, or worthless priests. Okay? And the only person who can understand and hear her and make a difference is her God. And that is the point of this story, that it seems like he is impelling her forward to go to him As we said, Habakkuk recently goes to the Lord with his concern, his complaint. Where else would you go? And is the Lord really bothered when we come to him? All right, a couple things I want us to notice here. First of all, notice in chapter 1 of what Hannah did with her hurt. We'll see what she did with her son and then what she does with her joy. But what did she do with her hurt, first of all? First thing I see under that is that she acknowledged the Lord's sovereignty. Jews were taught that every facet of their lives was under the control of the Almighty God. Example. Everything from nature, the amount of rain, the abundance of their crop, that was due to God. What else? She didn't get them all. All right, a victory in battle was certainly of the Lord. How their flocks did, how their families did, how their business did, all these things were seen as coming back to the dealing of God. If it's all under his control, Hannah seems to know rightly to go to him, as should we. In verses 5 and 6, we read twice, because the Lord had closed her womb. Look with me over in chapter 2, verses 6 and 7, where there's kind of a subtle reference there to the sovereignty. Well, not a subtle reference to the sovereignty of God, but maybe one to her former condition. She says, the Lord kills and brings to life. He brings down to Sheol and raises up. The Lord makes poor and makes rich. He brings low and he exalts. How are we about seeing that the Lord can bless others in an area that he doesn't bless us, that he withholds? Sometimes we overlook the things that he has given and prospered in our lives. But when we go to him with something that we say, this seems like a good thing, and Lord, you will not withhold any good thing. This seems like a good thing, and it is not given to us. How do we handle that when it seems like the Lord is withholding from us? We learn from Job in the early chapters, Job chapter 2 and verse 10, that Job says he has the power to give life and to take it. In Job's, he had prosperity, which the Lord had given, which the Lord could take away, which the Lord later could give many times over. And sometimes we act as if finding the right job or finding the right mate is somehow our responsibility. And the purpose of prayer is helping God see it our way, when that is not the case at all. Fact is, as we see in Samuel, every dimension, every act in our life, every need that we have is under his control. He is providing. At all times, under all conditions, God is good. I think we should hold to that truth more than our right to be happy or our right to succeed or our right to have things. We should say, the only thing that I can hold to, because I deserve nothing, the only thing I can hold to is that my God is good no matter what he gives me or takes away or gives again. She acknowledges the Lord's sovereignty in these verses when she prays to the Lord. Secondly, in verses 9 and 10, we see that she prayed out of great distress. After they'd eaten and drunk in Shiloh, Hannah rose. Now Eli, the priest, was sitting on the seat beside the doorpost of the temple of the Lord. She was deeply distressed and prayed to the Lord and wept bitterly. Going back to verse 4, it says, on the day when Elkanah sacrificed, he would give portions to Peninnah's wife and all her sons and daughters. The idea here, I'm going to read to you from Deuteronomy chapter 12, but you did not go to the temple empty-handed. This was a family worship affair. Let me read to you from Deuteronomy 12, verses 17 and 18. You may not not eat within your towns the tithe of your grain, or of your wine, or of your oil, or of the firstborn of your herd, or of your flock, or of any vow offerings that you vow, or free will offerings, or the contribution that you present. But you shall eat them before the Lord your God in the place that the Lord your God will choose, you and your son and your daughter and your male servant and your female servant and the Levite who is within your towns. And listen, and you shall rejoice before the Lord your God in all that you undertake. Take care that you do not neglect the Levite as long as you live in your land. So all of this was to be done as a family and with joy. It was part of the worship. She prays out of great distress. She acknowledges the sovereignty of God, and then she prays out of great distress in verses 9 and 10. When she pours out her heart before the Lord in this book, in this chapter, I think it's one of only two or three times, maybe the only time, first time, that a prayer of a woman is recorded in the Old Testament. When you and I come to grips with the fact, we say, you know, no one is in control but God. I'm certainly not in control. When Hannah realized, my husband can't change this. I can't change this. My priest can do nothing about it. I will go to the Lord. She goes to the only one who makes a difference. Today, the person who is depressed or disadvantaged or afflicted has all kinds of labels to choose from or ones that society pins on them. They're manic this or they're co that. And for a lot of people, it seems like some kind of therapy is their first choice and prayer would be their very last choice. But you and I, like Hannah, should let our troubles drive us to the Lord, not drive us from the Lord. And there's always that choice. What will I do with this problem in my life? Will I blame God or will I bless God? Will I run from God or am I going to run to the Lord? Prayer is not a time for blame shifting or finger pointing, but praising and obeying and thanking the Almighty. Notice in verse 11, another thing that she does is we're studying from the life of this would-be mother what we should do all the time, not just the mothers here, but all of us all the time. In verse 11, she submitted to God's will. Where do you see that? And she vowed a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your servant and remember me and not forget your servant, but will give to your servant a son, then I will give to the Lord all the days of his life, and no razor shall touch his head. By the way, a little study. I think that in verse 3 is we read throughout the Old Testament this expression, especially in the Psalms and in Isaiah, the Lord of hosts, which means what? The Lord of the armies or the Lord of the hosts. Is that heavenly armies or earthly armies or friendly armies or enemy armies? What is that? Yes. Again, the answer is always with Pastor Hamilton, E, all of the above, okay? He is Lord of it all. It is used in verse 3 by her husband, or Samuel records, to sacrifice to the Lord of hosts. And in her prayer, verse 10, she speaks of the Lord of hosts. I wonder if Samuel learned to pray this way from hearing his mother. Don't know that for sure. But that we would all sing with conviction as Hannah saying in chapter 2 and verse 10, the adversaries of the Lord shall be broken to pieces. Against them he will thunder in heaven. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth. He will give strength as king and exalt the horn of the anointed. Man won't prevail God certainly will. She, in her weakness, and yet by her faith, she trusts in the Lord, and the Lord answers, and in a glorious way. The only thing better in that day than having children was being seen as being barren, and then having children, both the mother and the child were seen as being very blessed. Remember, this lady makes this vow. She worships this way when she doesn't have the greatest examples around her. It's either Eli, a very weak priest, or Hophni and Phinehas, very wicked, worthless priest. Sometimes to be able to say, well, I'd be stronger in my faith if I had better examples. That wasn't really maybe necessarily the case in her life. But she vows this vow. A vow is not a deal with God. All right, God, let me tell you, this is the way this is going to work. You sign on the line. Here's how it's going to work. It was actually an act of worship before God. A vow was a pledge to give to God, the privilege of giving back to God. A Nazirite vow, any kind of a vow of this nature was an act of one's worship, saying, Lord, it all belongs to you. You bless me in this way, and this will be given back to you. That's what we should be saying all the time. She submitted to the will of God. And then in verses 12 through 19, she worshiped the Lord in the spirit of faith. As she continued praying before the Lord, Eli observed her mouth. She was speaking in her heart. She's speaking inaudibly, and her voice was not heard, and Eli took her to be a drunken woman. I think it's safe to say that she was never more sober-minded than she was at this point. And I think that this is probably a really tragic commentary on Israel at this time, that a priest sees somebody's mouth moving and no words coming out and jumps to the conclusion that they're drunk. And I wonder if drunkenness was more common than supplication before God at that point. And he says, how long will you go on being drunk? Put away wine. She says, no, Lord, I'm not. No, my Lord, I am a woman troubled in spirit. I've neither drunk wine nor strong drink. I've been pouring out my heart before the Lord. Do not regard your servant as a worthless woman, as a wicked woman, as a daughter of Belial. Interesting in the story, who is identified in this next chapter as worthless? Hophni and Phinehas. Here's a father that doesn't seem to be able to rein in his family, and yet here's a godly woman praying before him, and he's permissive of his sons, and yet he's very quick to go to judgment on her, and yet even that doesn't seem to dissuade her. So she explains her plight. She tells of her petition. He answers her about God's provision. The Lord will answer. And that moves her to worship. When he says, may the Lord, let's see, verse 17, go in peace, the God of Israel grant your petition that you've made to him. And she said, let your servant find favor in your eyes. Then the woman went her way, and here's that food statement again, and ate, and her face was no longer sad. So in faith, before, she didn't wait till the child was born. She didn't wait till the child was conceived. At the promise of God, her appetite returns, her joy is demonstrated, and she goes to worship. So she didn't wait for the birth. She acknowledged the blessing of God. She takes God at his word. That's what she did with her hurt. And that's what we should do with our hurt. We should acknowledge the sovereignty of God. We should pray to God out of our deep distress. We should worship the Lord in a spirit of faith. We should take God at his will. Let's look what she did with this son. And here becomes clear as a Mother's Day message. She, first of all, in verses 20 and following, she nurtured him as a loving mother. And I want to remind you of the ministry of motherhood. She nurtured him, and that was her job. God used Samuel, as I said, at a very critical time. There didn't seem to be vision. There didn't seem to be order. And she dedicates him. Instead of, in verses 21 and through 24, make it clear that instead of making two trips or instead of going to the temple and then having to go back home with him and then weaning him and then going back again, she's not reneging on her promise here, but she is... it's a difficult but a very blessed trip, wouldn't you say? I think her tears, sometimes her tears of joy and her tears of sorrow, all got mixed together. And by giving Samuel love and nurture and care in those infant years, she was doing a service before the Lord. She was honoring God. In Titus chapter 2 and verse 4, the older women, and I'm sorry, at least on Mother's Day I didn't say bag, or what was that again, Bob? But the older women are to train the young women to love their husbands and children. The flip side of that, Proverbs chapter 1 and verse 8, is that children are to forsake not the teaching of your mother. Both sides, people before God, acknowledge their responsibility, and things go better. Mothers, present day mothers, future mothers, new mothers, you may or may not have had an example of a great mother, of a kindly, affectionate, submissive, strong, but sweet mother. I mean, I can't find one or two words to describe my mother or mother-in-law. I've been doubly blessed that way. But I tell us what we all have. We all have the example of a God who tells us in Hosea chapter 11, he says, after saying that these false idols, they didn't take you up. These pagans, they had to be born on their beasts. That tells you how powerful they are. They had to be carried around because they're powerless. God says, over against that, he says, I took them up by their arms, speaking of Israel. I led them with the cords of kindness, with the bands of love, and I bent down to them and fed them. Now, praise God if you say, the way that I learned how to be a godly woman, the way I learned how to be a nurturing mother and a sweet wife was by reading the scriptures and being instructed by the Holy Spirit and watching and being taught by other Christian sisters in the Lord. I hope others could give that testimony as well. What did Hannah do with her son? She nurtured him as a loving mother. Secondly, she dedicated him to the service of God. She dedicated him to the service of God. So the one who was asked of the Lord, verse 20, was accordingly named Samuel, which means has the idea that God listens. And she took him and gave him to the temple as soon as possible. Many mothers might gladly do that in the teen years, but wouldn't do that at 3 and 4 when they're still cuddly. Her dedication, her obedience must have been a rebuke when she has to come back and tell Samuel, remember the woman who was praying and you jumped to a conclusion, but then rightly you said, well, may the Lord bless you. I am that woman. This is that child. And God provided. If you look over to chapter 2, and we remember this, verses 18 and 19, Samuel was ministering before the Lord, a boy clothed with a linen ephod, and his mother used to make for him a little robe and take it to him each year when she went up with her husband to offer the yearly sacrifice. Then Eli would bless Elkanah and his wife and say, "May the Lord give you children by this woman for the petition she asked of the Lord." So then they would return to their home. Our text in verse 28 says that she brought the child to Eli, and then she worshiped the Lord there. It sound familiar? Shouldn't that be the goal of every Christian parent? To instruct this child about God, to dedicate, to give this child to God, to worship before this child, we should have that same goal. Then I want us to close by noticing in chapter 2, the last part of chapter 1, chapter 2, what she did with her joy. With her sorrow, with her hurt, she brings it before the Lord. With her son, she gives him to God. She nurtures him, and then she dedicates him. With her joy, what does she do with that? Verse 1, "My heart exults in the Lord." This is her Mother's Day song, and it has a little different theme. She exults in the Lord. "My horn is exalted in the Lord. My mouth derides my enemies because I rejoice in your salvation. There is none holy like the Lord. For there is none beside you. There is no rock like our God." In verses 2 through 9, you really could summarize all that. She meditated on God's majesty. Everything that she says in those verses speaks of the might and the majesty, the supremacy of God. In her prayer, notice with me, that she says that she praises God in verse 2 for his holiness. In verse 3, for his knowledge, a God of knowledge. In verse 4, for his might, the bows of the mighty are broken, the feeble bind on strength. In verses 5, 6, and 7, for about the sovereignty of God, how he provides, and the barren are bear seven, and but she who has many children is forlorn. God is in control over all of this. In verses 8 and 9, she praises God for his compassion. Verse 8, he raises up the poor from the dust. He lifts up the needy from the ash heap to make them sit with princes and inherit a seat of honor. For the pillars of the earth are the Lord's, and on them he has set the world. He will guard the feet of his faithful ones, but the wicked will be cut off in darkness, for not by might shall a man prevail. She meditated on God's majesty. And mothers, that is one of the greatest things that you can do in worship of God, in contribution to the godliness and the unity of your family, is for you to meditate on the majesty of God. It may not always work or be well received to preach to your children as you're driving to school. Although as I was listening to your testimonies, some of the most concise and to the point instruction that I can remember, or sometimes as I was being driven up by my mother or my father to the church and dropped off a little bit early for youth group meetings. Ours were a little earlier on Sunday than the Sunday service. And, you know, things like be a leader, be humble, listen. You know, sometimes it was just a concise down to a few words or something of that nature. She meditated on God's majesty. And then in chapter 2, verses 1, and then also in verse 10, she rejoices over God's activity. My heart exults. Verse 10, the Lord will judge. She exalt the horn of the anointed. He will give strength. The predominant theme in her Mother's Day message to us is the irresistible might of God, that he is sovereign, that he is judge, that he controls all things. Here's a woman that says, I went from being distressed, I couldn't even eat, to being one who was greatly blessed, and I give God thanks. But I want to say more than just God provided. I want to say God is in control of everything. It's enough to say, you know, God is in control of my life. And absolutely he is. But to be able to say he is moving all things, it is all under his control. He is sovereign Lord of it all. I have two questions that I want you to help me out with as we close here. Thinking of just nothing deeply doctrinal about this passage tonight, just a very practical one. But how does Hannah's dedication of Samuel instruct us about parenting today? I don't think she did it to be an example. But what about the fact that she gave her son to the Lord should instruct or direct our idea of parenting today? Maybe it's so obvious, maybe it's already been said. Karen? Okay, so that God gives us children that he can be glorified, we can serve him through them. What else?
Our children are not ours, just stewards of them for a short period of time.
Yeah, I put that in my notes. We're just managers. Parents make a grievous mistake to say, well, these are my children, and they are here to be a good name for me, and they are here to take care of me later, or to make me look good, or to do on the ball field what I never could, or to keep up my great name, or you set yourself up for a tremendous fall. But when we say, you know what, I am just a temporary steward of this child. And when your children are young and years of having them, you lose sight of the fact, boy, they will all be gone one of these days. Just about the time they get interesting, they leave. You know that? Isn't that interesting? But they move out. And to be able to look back and say, I hope we pointed to Christ in this. We're managers. We're what else about the? Anything anybody else have to add about how Hannah dedicated her son instructs us on being godly parents today? At all times, she's mindful of this purpose. She's pointing him in that direction. This is a child that is going to be given back to the Lord. I've got to instruct him and get him ready to be used in the temple. And interesting, when he was weaned, you know, 3-4 years of age, that he was given back and raised there, but he was the property of the Lord. Second question, what does Hannah's example instruct us about parenting? That one's not as good a question as this. What does this story tell us about our God? Because that's why this is here, is not for us to focus on a dedicated woman, but for us to glorify our God. So what does this passage tell us about our God? Christine. All right, that he drew the son that she gave. Yes, she was giving, but the Lord had a plan for his life at all times and had a great purpose and used him mightily. Yes. What else does this tell us about our God? He answers prayer. That he wanted, God was not impositioned or impatient with this woman who came before him out of a distress. We won't take it away. Anybody else? Ken.
His timing is perfect.
All right, his timing is perfect.
He'll test us through difficulties, too. Even he's the one who made her barren in the first place.
All right, the sovereignty of the Lord, that the one who had made her barren, and sometimes we want to back away from that. Well, the Lord permits certain things. It says whose heart, who is made barren by the Lord, okay? And only the Lord could reverse them, and only as it glorified him. And so he remained in control of that and could change that and answer a prayer in his perfect timing. What else? What does this tell us about our God? It's a great story. It's more than that. It's a great account of Hannah. No, it's more than that. What it, how does this instruct us about our God? David. Never thought of that. What if she would have been the one that had multiple children? Would she have been as inclined to really trust in her God? Or she might have been close to her husband. She would have been very attached to her motherly duties. I don't know. That's a good question. But the Lord, what we do know is that through that absence, that void in her life, there was a recognition of a need that nobody could change but God. She goes to God. She's not even understood by the priest or by her husband. That was the first and last time a husband ever messed up like that, by the way. I was thinking when I read that, I thought, you know, I stopped and I prayed for me, and I prayed for the men of the church. I thought, you know, Lord, help us to be compassionate to our wives. I certainly haven't arrived in that category, and we could all improve. But to be able to say, you know, Lord, help me to know what to not just leave all the compassionate care to my wife towards our children. Help me to be compassionate as well. Help me to be to think before I ask a question like, am I not better than, okay. But to be compassionate. And really, I prayed for myself and for you men that we would be able to be good counselors towards each other when there are men in our church that are hurting. Instead of kind of keeping our distance or saying something just off the wall and unnecessary and unbiblical, that we would say something, rather we would say, you know, that helped. That helped. Can I share with you what somebody shared with me when I was going through a situation like that, and give a Bible verse or to pray or come alongside here? Anything else before we close about what does this instruct us about our God? Diane? Okay. Not only that he has the power to answer prayer and in his timing, but that he can do this. His heart is always inclined to us. And in certain pagan cultures, they would see God as being grotesque or being powerful but detached. It certainly didn't show a God who was compassionate and knew the needs, it was inclined and wanted to hear. And in the glorious scriptures that we have, we're told of God who bows over to hear our, to inclines himself to hear our petition. I thought of that verse in Luke 1:37 the angel instructs Mary, for with God nothing shall be impossible. Our God is the God of the impossible. And instead of arm-twisting our God, he delights in hearing our petitions and granting those requests. All right, let's stand and be dismissed in a word of prayer.